How did a childhood tragedy influence Judy Blume's new book? Judy will be here to talk about her new novel for grown-ups, In the Unlikely Event.
This book is not autobiographical, although people seem to think that it is. It's not. It's not about my coming of age.
What to read about traveling, even if you are not actually traveling? Liesl Schillinger will join us to talk about our summer reading travel roundup.
This was exhilarating. I feel like Phileas Fogg. I really kind of had to do a whole lot of reading before I figured out which countries and which writers were drawing me most.
What are the yummy mummies of the Upper East Side really like? Vanessa Grigoriadis will join us to talk about her review of Wednesday Martin's Park Avenue Primates.
I like the book. It's not for everybody. Some people will find it just way too silly and like she's taking this all too seriously.
Alexander Alter will tell us what's going on this week in the publishing world. Greg Coles has bestseller news. And something new. This week, we'll give readers a say on our bookends question. Do literary prizes like the Bailey's Prize help or hinder women writers? This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Judy Blume joins us now. She does not need any introduction, but for those who have not read anything for the last 50 years, she is the author of, among other books, for grown-ups, Wifey, Summer Sisters, and for everyone who's grown up again in the last four decades, she has written Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret. Dini, and my personal favorite, starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, among many other books. Her new book is In the Unlikely Event. Judy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
This is a book, we should say up front, for adults. Did you know when you started it, this is a book for grown-ups?
I never know. And to tell you the truth, I hate putting books into categories because, you know, when I was 12 and 13, there were no YA books, so I was reading widely in my parents' bookshelves, and so I was reading everything. And so if a teenager wants to read this book, great. Why not?
The protagonist of the book is a teenager at the center of it, ninth grade Jewish girl, Miri Ammerman. Tell us about her.
You know, the whole book came to me at once. So it wasn't so much Miri, nor did I know at that time that everyone would say that Miri is the, you know, the main character. I guess she must be because everybody says she is. But I, you know, because I was trying to create three families and several generations in each family, I guess I didn't think of it that way. Although, yes, Miri's voice starts it and kind of ends it. And so I guess she is the main character. Yeah, I like her, Miri. Well, I have to like them all, you know, or why spend 5 years of my life with them? And that's what it's taken.
How long were you thinking about the book before you started writing? Or did you come up with this idea and start writing?
It came in a flash to me, unlike any other book I've ever written. I mean, my books, you know, usually come with a character and a loose idea, and I know where I'm starting, and I think I know where I'm going, but maybe I'm not, and I don't know anything that's going to happen in the middle. And this book came to me in a flash. You know, I knew this story. This story's been inside me since I'm 14 years old. I was younger than Miri. And I'm a writer, and I've been writing for 40-something years, and I never thought about writing this story, and I don't quite understand that unless the events were so buried, and yet they weren't so buried because my daughter became an airline pilot. When she read, you know, an early draft of the book, she said, "Mother, I can't believe this. You never told me this story." So maybe it was. Now I think, okay, Judy, this is the book you were born to write. Tell this story, to write this book.
So tell me about this flash moment. You said that it came to you in a flash. Do you remember where you were?
Yes, it was only in 2009, so I remember it very well. It was at the Key West Literary Seminar. I'm on the board, and I love to be there. A then young and not very well-known writer named Rachel Kushner. The theme that year, each year it's a different theme, and the theme in 2009 was new voices. She had been invited as a new voice, and she was on stage talking about her first novel, Telex from Cuba, a book that I had loved very much. And she was talking about where she got the idea, because everybody always wants to know, where do you get your ideas? And she said, well, stories that her mother told her about having grown up in Cuba in the 50s. Now, it wasn't anything to do with Cuba that jumped, you know, that knocked me over the head. It was in the 50s. And when she said stories in the 50s, I mean, truly, the light bulb went off over my head, and it was like, oh my God, I have a story, and I have to tell this story. And this came to me unlike any other book. It came to me in that flash with plot and characters, not specific characters, but I knew that there would be three families. I knew that it would involve the three crashes, take place in, you know, my hometown of Elizabeth, New Jersey, in the winter of 51-52. I just knew I couldn't wait to start. I've never felt that way. I usually dread starting. And that was over a weekend. And on Monday morning, I began my research, which lasted, I guess, about 5 months until, you know, people who know me and care about me and understand nonfiction writing said to me, yes, we know, Judy, you're having a wonderful time doing the research, but now you have to start to write the book and tell this story. And that was January 2009. In my defense, I did take 2 years off to work on a movie, the movie of Tiger Eyes.
Your son was involved with that, correct?
Yes, yes. We wrote the screenplay together and he directed it, yes. A very, very happy experience.
Did the writing come easily once you had that idea and you had done that research when you sat down to write it? Did it just flow? Did it feel like it had been a long time since you'd written a novel for adults, or did it just come to you?
No, that doesn't make any difference because, during those years, it's not as if I hadn't been writing. I wrote, I don't know, 4 chapter books for young children and maybe even a fudge book. And, I wasted a lot of time doing movie scripts and things that were never going to happen. But, you know, they're all learning experiences, and they were interesting. That wasn't the problem. I mean, the problem is the same thing every time I start. It's like, it's hard. It wasn't in the beginning. I mean, I had a lot of stuff inside me, and it just came spilling out. It's much harder now because I don't want to repeat myself, and mm-hmm. I want to be fresh and spontaneous, and this book was a real challenge.
What was the particular challenge?
What was the challenge?
Yeah, with this book in particular. What was the most challenging part of it?
There are a lot of characters and a lot of events. I don't write descriptive prose well. I try never to write descriptive prose. And I'm thankful for the wonderful newspaper reporters of the day because through their stories, I was able to describe these horrific events. I don't think I would have been able to do it otherwise, and I was determined to use the language of the 50s. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, it wasn't like you could come home from school or work and put on the TV and there would be all the news coverage, because while we had TV, there was no news coverage like this. So it was up to them to paint the picture of what was going on, and up to the photographers who worked with the papers. In fact, there was a boy in school just a year ahead of me who ran out into the night. He lived near the third crash and took pictures, and he actually sold those photos to the local newspaper, now defunct, the Elizabeth Daily Journal. I don't know that I ever saw his pictures, but I certainly knew him well.
You know, when you went back and read all those newspapers, the language that they used, the way in which they wrote must have been so different because of people's reliance on print.
You know, my favorite was broke in half like a swollen cream puff, describing a plane that came down. Mm-hmm. It broke in half like a swollen cream puff. And then there was another description that I really had to use, which was, you know, fell from the sky like a wounded, angry bird. I mean, we don't do that anymore. We don't use that kind of language anymore. And so I recently read somewhere that, you know, Bloom's descriptions are a little purple prosy there. I'm thinking, you know, They're not my descriptions. This is the way it was described in the newspapers. And thank goodness, you know, for the newspapers. I don't really think I read the newspapers then. What I knew, I did know a lot. I mean, my father was a dentist. The most autobiographical character, or the character who's most like someone I know, whichever way you want to put it, is Dr. O, the dentist, in the book, based on my father, the guy that everybody loved. All the kids liked to be at our house because he was fun, and he was a wonderful guy.
In all the books that you've written, had you written about your father in this way before, sort of finding him
yes,
within?
In your very favorite of my books, starring Sally J. Friedman as herself, which is truly my most autobiographical book. This book is not autobiographical, although people seem to think that it is. It's not. It's not about my coming of age. You know, it's so fictional. But starring Sally J. Friedman as herself is autobiographical in that that's the kind of kid I was, and that was my family.
The book has just come out, but you've already done quite a bit of media already. Has anything in the reception so far surprised you?
I've read, you know, what certain readers have said about it. I'm always, you know, fascinated by people who either see it the same way I do, and then it's like, oh, yes, yes, or see it in a completely different way than I do. Like, you know, that this is Bloom's own coming of age. I swear to you, this is not Bloom's coming of age, but I was there. Unlike Miri, I never saw a crash, but I have heard now from many people who either had seen it as children or who were somehow touched by it, whose families were touched by what happened, and I'm hoping that I get to meet a lot of them on the road.
I imagine when you do meet your readers often, that the reading of your books is sort of part of so many people's coming-of-age story. What does that feel like for you when people come up to you and say, oh, my God, Judy Blume, Deanie, or, oh, my God, you know, Tales of a Fourth Grade Nothing?
Well, it's wonderful. You know, it's very satisfying, and there's a lot of tears on both sides. I always keep Kleenex on the table. But this is not something that I can think about every day, or I'd be paralyzed. I would never be able to write because it would be too scary. You know, the idea of disappointing my fans, I have to shoo that thought away. This is a book, whether or not it satisfies or disappoints my fans, this is a book that I had to write. I'm glad that I did, and I'm glad that it's over, and that now all I have to do is talk about it. I find it interesting to talk about it, and it's different, and, you know, it's a time and a place.
And that book, again, is In the Unlikely Event. Judy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Liesl Schillinger is here now to talk about her roundup of travel books in this week's summer reading issue. Hi, Liesl.
Hello, Pamela.
Is this your first time doing our travel roundup?
I have never done it before, yes. This was exhilarating. I feel like Phileas Fogg.
I did it twice myself when I was a freelancer, and it's one of my favorite things. Our editor here who handles travel books will send you a huge pile of books, and you get to pick based on your interests and what looks best and any themes that might emerge. Did you find it hard to narrow down the pile?
It was terrifically hard, yes. I mean, there were 9 books. I think I started with more than 20. The thing is, I have a kind of voracious interest in every place. So I really kind of had to do a whole lot of reading before I figured out which countries and which writers were drawing me most. And one of the places, one of the books is about a place that I've never been before, and that's because nobody's ever been there before. And that is, of course, The Lost World of Atlantis. Just so I would begin in the proper mood of correct confusion being introduced to a new world, I started with that one. And then everything kind of followed from that.
Because you're a big traveler as well. Have you been to most of the places in the other books that you covered?
I adore traveling, and I did it mostly in my teens and 20s, and Okay, actually, no, I guess I still travel. But, I mean, I just have such a great love for going someplace where everything I see is new, something I've never seen before. And so what I liked about one of these books, I think it actually was the Atlantis book, mentioned that Proust said that the true voyage of discovery isn't so much seeing new landscapes as having new eyes. And so it was fun for me to revisit some of the places I've been through these books. And one of them was Granada in Spain. I had no idea that there had been this gorgeous time when Islam and Judaism and Christianity lived alongside and flourished in Granada, where, you know, there's the Alhambra Castle and there are orange groves and there are parties and it's all very mystical. But when I went there 10 years ago, it was just a cool place to visit, you know, right. And I wish I'd known more about it. And so one of these books, a man and his wife go and live in the Albaicin, which was the quirky little mazy neighborhood right in the heart of Granada, and they get a house. And so I got to revisit history with his eyes.
I'm going
to
run through quickly the 9 titles of the books, and then we'll talk a little bit more specifically about some of them. You already mentioned Meet Me in Atlantis, My Obsessive Quest to Find the Sunken City by Mark Adams, as well as Granada, A Pomegranate in the Hand of God by Stephen Nightingale. We're also going to talk, at least in part, hopefully, about the rest of them. The Almost Nearly Perfect People, Behind the Myth of the Scandinavian Utopia by Michael Booth. I am very interested in what they found out, since everything Scandinavian seems to be dandy these days. Werner Herzog of Walking in Ice, Munich to Paris, November 23rd to 14th. December 1974. Kara Richardson Whiteley's book, Gorge, My Journey Up Kilimanjaro at 300 Pounds. Travels in Vermeer, a memoir by Michael White. Eating Vietnam, Dispatches from a Blue Plastic Table by Graham Holiday. We're getting to the end here. The Fault Line, Traveling the Other Europe from Finland to Ukraine by Paolo Ramiz. And finally, The Porcelain Thief, Searching the Middle Kingdom for Buried China by Huan Su. What unites this this motley crew that we've got here?
The first one was Stubborn Quests, and then it went into Journeys of Exploration, and then it went into kind of fantasy, people trying to find something that they thought was lost. And so all of those books, they led to each other. You know, one example of how one book came out of another is the Atlantis book shows a man in, he goes to Santorini. He's exploring 4 of the places where they think Atlantis may reside. One of them is in the Greek island of Santorini, which is formed around the caldera of an exploded volcano. And I had walked through Akrotiri, that architectural site, in 2001 and seen, just to my astonishment, that these people, they had plumbing, they had their vases, they had their decorations. The buildings were filled with ash, not lava, so they were able to excavate them like 50 years ago. But I hadn't known at the time that that was a putative location for Atlantis. But then when he went to the Andalusia later in the book, another site, well, then I was brought back to Granada. And so that was one point of connection. Another book was the book about The Almost Nearly Perfect People by Michael Booth. He's an Englishman who lives in Denmark, has a Danish wife. He's been there 10 years. And he is a very waspish, funny person who's debunking the idea that Scandinavia is perfect. Well, I've never been to Denmark, but now I want to go because of Michael Booth in Copenhagen. But that kind of led me to another journey by an Italian journalist named Paolo Ramiz, who grew up in Trieste. So he's grown up on the border of Eastern Europe, because it's just this northern eastern part of Italy that blends into so many other nations. He wanted to recapture the siege mentality of pre-Iron Curtain Eastern Europe. And so he went by train up from Scandinavia. So that, you know, that's where I got it to him from Booth. And then down to the Black Sea, down
the
to the Mediterranean.
Of Eurasia.
Yeah, down to the, yeah. And so I jumped from one stepping stone of the author's imagination to the next natural stepping stone that followed. I tried to span as much of the world as I could in this roundup because I didn't want to be Eurocentric. There's one book about Vietnam and one book about China. The Chinese one, The Porcelain Thief by Huan Su, just really interested me because of the author's attitude. He's American, but he's also Chinese. He didn't speak very good Chinese. He grew up in Utah. And he just came across the happenstance that his great-great-grandfather was some kind of practically a feudal lord in China, possessed this trove of china, of porcelain, imperial china, which he'd buried when the Japanese army invaded, and then the family just abandoned it and ended up living in America. Well, some of them moved back. But so what's interesting to him is this guy, Huan Su, is fascinated by the family story, but he's really conflicted about China. He's got real issues with the country he comes from and with the national traits he finds in his relatives, which he really resents. And so it's both a journey of rediscovery of what happened to this China and treasure, but also of his family, of his roots. Not that he doesn't necessarily even embrace them so warmly, but he gets to understand them. And then I jumped from him to a book called Eating Vietnam by a gonzo journalist named Graham Holiday.
Let's make a little connection food-wise to one book we haven't mentioned, Gorge, My Journey Up Kilimanjaro at 300 Pounds by Kara Richardson-Whiteley. What was her purpose? Was it, I want to lose weight walking up Kilimanjaro, or I want to show that I can do this at 300 pounds, or what was her?
Well, she has a complex skein of motives. She's already gone. Kara Richardson-Whiteley lives in New Jersey. She has a wonderful husband, wonderful children, but she bears not only the weight of her excess pounds, which she writes that she's as big as a smart car bumper or something like that. She's humorous and rueful about her weight, but she is really fed up with being underestimated. And she was sick of having the freight of these stereotypes people levy on fat people. And she has people always talking about her pretty face. She has a narrow torso and then she gets big lower down. So she has done this journey three times. She's done it for charity. So she's, you know, raising money for a good cause. But it's just to show that you can do a lot of things, no matter what you look like, no matter what people think about you. But one of the journeys, she didn't make it up the top. She's had two that she has. But this journey is not only about her struggle. She takes along some friends. And some of them are really sporty and skinny. And so you learn through the course of their journey that mountaineers come in all sizes. The journey is the destination, but even if you don't get there, there are reasons to feel excited about undertaking the expedition, and there are ways to feel proud about your adventurous spirit. And so that's what she writes about, and she blogs about it too.
Of all these books, I'm going to ask you that horrible, tough question. Did you have a favorite?
Well, I did, and the favorite is very personal. The Fault Line by Paolo Ramiz, where he goes from Finland through Karelia, which is northern Russia, where peasants still live in little wood cabins on islands, and they don't really work. They kind of garden and live in this folkloric way. That book really touched me because I've spent a lot of time in Russia. I lived there for a while in the 90s. My parents are Russian professors. We have many Russian and Ukrainian friends. And the point he makes is that we think of the capital cities of these nations, and the airports, though, aren't the way that you get to know a people. It's in the train stations. And so by journeying overland and in trains, he had personal interactions that were so rich and so surprising. It is the least jaded book you'll ever find. And so he made a lot of those countries fresh for me, up from the northern tip of Scandinavia, down through Estonia and Latvia and the Baltics, you know, down through Ukraine. And he touches on politics. But what he does is humanize these people and bring out the color of each nation's temperament and character, which still survives in a much less monolithic way than we tend to think of the Eastern Bloc.
With a lot of travel books, you find yourself either thinking, now I really want to go to this place, or now I know I don't need to go there. I've read about it and I know I don't want to go. Did you have that reaction with any of these books?
I have never been to China, and I've been to Japan, but reading The Porcelain Thief, I guess, made me even more afraid to go to China, because Huan Su's reservations made a lot of sense to me. And so I definitely would like to go, if I go to China, with somebody who can interpret for me, who can guide the trip, because he speaks pretty good Chinese, but he had a lot of culture shock. And so.
All right. Well, Liesl Schillinger with the Travel Roundup. Liesl, thank you so much.
Thank you, Pamela. It was a lot of fun.
Alexandra Alter joins us now with news from the publishing world. Hi, Alexandra.
Hi, Pamela.
So this is a big week for us.
This is a big week for the publishing industry. It's Book Expo of America, which is the largest trade event for American publishers. And I think somewhere around more than 20,000 people, booksellers, authors, publishers, have gathered this week in New York at the lovely Jacob Javits Center. And unlike other book fairs, you know, the London Book Fair or the Frankfurt Book Fair, there aren't big international deals going on here. There's not millions of dollars being thrown around for translation rights. Instead, it's sort of an opportunity for independent booksellers and even fans to come and meet their favorite authors.
Librarians and bloggers.
It's basically just this mass of people who love books. And it's a great preview for some of the big titles that are coming out in the fall, too.
And lots of authors in town.
Tons of authors in town. So some of the books that people seem to be really excited about in the galleys that are being snapped up are Garth Risk's Halberg's City on Fire, which is coming out in October. And people have been following that book, you know, for years since it made headlines for getting a $2 million advance for this debut author. And another debut novel that is getting a lot of buzz is Ruth Ware's novel In a Dark Wood, which is kind of in the vein of Gone Girl and Girl on the Train. It's sort of psychological suspense.
But there's no girl in the title.
They need to have a girl in the title. I think that's key. Speaking of girls in the title, there will be another Stieg Larsson book. Although the author is deceased, they found someone to continue on the series, and it's called The Girl in the Spider's Web, and that's coming out in late August. The other novel that people were snapping up on the floor was Jonathan Franzen's Purity, which is coming out this September.
And BEA opened up with a big interview that Franzen did with Laura Miller from Salon.
That was very interesting. He was saying that he's finding it's getting harder and harder to write novels. He felt like he'd used up all the easy material and now was having to dig a little bit deeper to find plots and characters. And the new novel is about a young woman whose name is Purity who lives in Oakland, who is saddled with student debt and follows this German activist to South America, where she sort of falls in with this Edward Snowden type, you know, WikiLeaks type person. So there's a little bit of global intrigue there.
This is also the second year for BookCon. What's that?
Yeah, that's exciting. So for the second year in a row, the expo has opened up not just to industry professionals, but to fans. And it's sort of modeled on Comic-Con. And that's, you know, when fans can come in and meet their favorite authors. This year, the big ticket authors are Judy Blume, who's publishing her first novel for adults in more than 16 years.
And she was on our podcast earlier, of course.
Yes. And John Green, who is promoting a movie adaptation of his novel Paper Towns, and Mindy Kaling and other sort of celebrity types. I think there'll be a few YouTube stars milling around. Of course,
YouTube stars.
Of course, James Patterson will make an appearance. And I understand he has a big announcement coming out.
Well, you know, we New Yorkers should take advantage of it while we can, because after staying put in New York for several years now, the fair is scheduled to move on to Chicago next year.
See you in Chicago next year then, I guess.
All right. Thanks, Alexandra.
Thanks, Pamela.
Vanessa Grigoriadis joins us now. She is a contributing editor at New York Magazine, at Rolling Stone Magazine, and at Vanity Fair. And this week, she reviews Primates of Park Avenue, a memoir by Wednesday Martin, a book that's already getting a lot of attention. Vanessa, thanks so much for being here.
Absolutely.
Okay, so this book has just been published. The author, Wednesday Martin, had an op-ed on the front, I think it was on the front cover, but prominently in the Sunday Review a couple of weeks ago. Let's start from the beginning. She calls this a memoir. What is this a memoir of?
Okay, so Wednesday Martin presents herself as, you know, every woman, very normal, albeit wealthy woman who lived in downtown Manhattan, who grew up in the Midwest, who has a PhD that isn't really quite specified, but has a lot to do with cultural studies. And she decides to move to the Upper East Side to give her children a better life, essentially, is what she says. It's cleaner, better schools, nice playgrounds. So, you know, she and her husband purchased a Park Avenue apartment. So it is structured as a memoir, but it's essentially life among the 1%.
there's a little bit of Stockholm syndrome going on here, too, right? She arrives as a downtown girl, a former Midwesterner, but she gets kind of taken in.
Yeah. I mean, halfway through the book, she says, you know, I, too, want a Birkin bag.
All right. So what's a Birkin bag to the uninitiated?
Okay. Well, to the uninitiated, although at this point, I mean, luxury is so inescapable that I think most people are figuring this one out. It's just a standard leather pocketbook that is quite large. And as she writes, you know, it's both beauty and functionality because you can have your computer and your file folders and all of that in there. A life of work and beauty is the advertisement that, you know, you are giving yourself as you walk down the street with it. But it's very expensive. So, you know, it can run $15,000, probably $100,000 for some of the more exclusive styles, and also very hard to get.
The irony being that everyone in this particular tiny little milieu has one. So it's a kind of total conformity, despite that veneer of individualism.
Right, exactly. And I mean, the fact is that whatever anyone wants to say about this book, and of course, there's things that she hears from hairdressers, and there's things that she hears from people in shoe stores that she throws in the book as crazy rites of the Upper East Side. You know, we all know that among very wealthy women, there is a certain amount of conformity, and everybody goes to SoulCycle, and everybody has a Birkin, and everybody has an Escalade with a driver, and everybody has a NetJets, you know, subscription, and everybody's got this and that. And that's part of keeping up with the Joneses, is keeping up with, you know, the rest of us are keeping up with the Kardashians, and they're keeping up with something, you know, they're keeping up with Bill Gates. So there's something very different going on there. The more wealth you get, it doesn't mean that you don't care what your peers in your social circle have. You actually care more.
Is this just about the Upper East Side, or does this apply to Silicon Valley and, you know, the beautiful parts of Dallas and Miami, or are there things that are very specifically New York?
Well, I think there's a very specific upper class, nearing middle age, young mommy look.
The yummy mummy look?
A yummy mummy look, exactly. And Lululemon, and instead of the minivan, you know, the Mercedes SUV, and a specific kind of jean that hugs your butt just right because you're a little bit older. I mean, that's across the board. But I do think, you know, Silicon Valley, they don't care about fashion. So I don't think, except for that very tiny kind of socialite scene in San Francisco. Like, I don't think you're seeing a lot of Birkin bags around in San Jose, but, you know, they've got a different scene going on there. In Miami and Dallas and places like that, yeah, I think you're basically seeing the same thing. It's a way of belonging. And, you know, she writes a lot about female-on-female domination, and that's the theme of the book in some ways, and that's what she's going to get attacked for. Because I don't think she makes it quite clear enough that she's really talking about moms who don't work here. And she may have not been, you know, she should have shaded that a little bit better. So I think she's going to get attacked by a lot of working moms who say, you know, we don't even have time for this stuff. And we make more money than our husbands. So give me a break. But, you know, stay-at-home moms are living a slightly different lifestyle. And at the upper reaches of society, they are, you know, engaging in certain rituals. And I think she does a good job of describing those.
So she talks about the TT, or top-tier schools. Her kids, I think, ended up at the 92nd Street Y. And she writes about that particular milieu. For those who are not in Manhattan or even Brooklyn, but elsewhere, or just not paying attention to this world, what's the 92nd Street Y? Like, what's this little corner that she's talking about of the Upper
right.
East Side?
Well, if you go on urbanbaby.com, you can read all about TT schools any hour of the day. She does, you know, again, a very good job of sending up the experience of trying to get your child into just the right TT nursery school so that they can go to just the right, you know, TT elementary school, middle school, high school, and then on to Harvard, which is the dream. You know, in New York City, people are paying, you know, $30,000 to have their children educated at 4 years old, and then, you know, goes up to 40 at five. And so that works out to about $1 million for primary school education when you do the math of the 12 years or whatever. And that's, you know, an extraordinary amount of money to spend just on any kid. And I'm not talking about kids who have, you know, really either special needs or kids who are just geniuses and you cannot possibly put them in a public school system, even a gifted and talented one. They must go to, you know, a TT school. You know, this is just your run-of-the-mill kid. And the compulsion to get kids into those schools, the donations that people are making to get those kids into the schools, and trying to impress the admissions counselors, et cetera, is just, you know, it's reached extraordinary proportions, and it's just incredibly silly. And I think everybody who lives in New York kind of, on one hand, knows it's really silly. On the other hand, lives in fear of not providing that for his or her child and perhaps not giving the child the best possible opportunities. You know, I think across the country, given the education system, everybody can relate to that, even if the private schools in their particular area are $10,000 a year, you know, versus 40, which is kind of extreme.
As a non-Upper East Sider, but a reader of the op-ed piece and of your review, I had a few burning questions. One was, does she still live on the Upper East Side, or has she moved away? And sort of how does that color her honesty and sort of transparency in terms of naming names and the specificity of what she's talking about?
I don't think she names names at all. So if anybody is going to figure out who is who, that, you know, that's going to be a guessing game, like a page six blind item. She has moved. She moved to the Upper West Side, which is, of course, less than a mile from the Upper East Side. So she's not that far away.
But worlds away.
Yeah, she didn't move to Missouri. Like, I mean, she's still going to see these people. She obviously made a calculation that she didn't care, you know, and that she was going to say what she wanted to say. And I respect her for doing that. You know, the parts of the book that are the hardest to read are when she does get her child into the school and finds that the moms don't want to talk to her and mm-hmm. the moms don't want to set up play dates with her child. And you know what? I think we can all relate to that. And maybe it's because where I send my child, everybody's a working mom. And so there's not a lot of, you know, laughter and boisterousness and coffee dates around drop-off, because we're all just like, oh, my God, get me out of here. I have things to do.
Right.
In her case, you know, she's saying nobody had anything to do, but nobody wanted to talk to me. You know, she was not a known quantity. She has no real background in society. She's not in the party pages of Hampton's magazine. She doesn't have a job that anybody coveted. Her husband doesn't have a job that anybody coveted. Moms sometimes want to know about that stuff. I mean, that's a fact. I like the book. It's not for everybody. Some people will find it, you know, just way too silly and like she's taking this all too seriously. But for, you know, the Bergdorf blonde readers or, you know, the kind of the people who grew up and they read, you know, The Devil Wears Prada and they're looking for something new about that kind of coterie grown up now. If you want to know what the lifestyle of the ex-assistant of Vogue and her new hedge fund husband is like on Park Avenue, I think this is pretty much as good as it gets.
Okay, I have one last question, and that's about the wife bonuses, because that's what the excerpt that ran in the Sunday Review focused on. And I'm just curious, does that ring true to you? Because I've heard a lot of skepticism about this idea.
I think she may have overstepped it a little bit. I mean, I don't think that it's crazy that prenups would have bonuses for wives that are tied to the husband's bonuses at his firm in terms of, okay, you get an extra $100,000 and you can go spend that on charities or your Birkin bag or whatever you want if I get X per year. Tying that to sexual performance or tying that to how well you keep the house for the children is preposterous. And I think, you know, would only happen in the rarest case. in general, she gets enough right that the book should be taken seriously.
Vanessa, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Vanessa Grigoriadis reviews this week Primates of Park Avenue, a memoir by Wednesday Martin in the Book Review. Something new this week. We're going to let listeners have something to say about bookends. Our column on the back page this week asks Zoe Heller and Dana Stevens about the Bailey's Women's Prize for Fiction, which will be awarded this week. Does a prize like this help or hurt the cause of women writers? Zoe Heller said, "I hate the idea of describing any sort of fiction as a cause. It makes it sound like something virtuous, but fundamentally tedious." And Dana Stevens noted, "A small part of me fears that the gated-off arena can too easily become a prison." But we wanted to ask readers and listeners what you think. John Williams joins me now, and he'll give us a little taste of what we heard back from our readers.
Hi, Pamela. You know, Zoe and Dana were both sort of came down essentially on the same side of this issue, which is to say that they're dubious about the uses of these prizes. Some readers agreed, others didn't. I think that M.L. Chadwick from Maine put it fairly well. He or she wrote, "The more contests, the more opportunities for one's work to be placed in the public view, the better. Let's not try to help women by reviling female-only competitions as a prison. For centuries, literary contests were male-only. That didn't seem to do the cause of male authors any harm." And there's a good point there. Someone who goes by the name Fast and Furious makes the good point, I think, that they discover a lot of writers through these prizes and these lists, and I think a lot of readers do in general, and that writers like Aimee McBride, Lionel Shriver, Rachel Cusk, Emily St. John Mandel, Allie Smith, this person says that they discovered all of these women through prizes like the Bailey's Prize, which was formerly known as the Orange Prize, and so they want these things to continue.
All right. Anyone else interesting weigh in? Not that everyone isn't interesting.
Yeah. Well, someone made the point that we already have other genres and identities that we use for awards. And so Al in Seattle says that we celebrate genres and niches, and there's more than enough stage, not enough really, to recognize and support great work. If we get rid of women-centered awards, let's get rid of any sci-fi awards too, or business-themed awards. I've picked up some great reads because of the Orange Prize and other such awards. Keep them coming.
You know what I want to come down on? Prizes for people under 40. What's that about, young people?
Yeah, let's get some elder awards.
That's right. How about prizes for people over 70? That's what I want. Next week, we'd like listeners to weigh in on burning questions about the book review. Not necessarily about bookends, but if you have a question that you've been wanting to ask us editors of the book review, please feel free to email us at books@nytimes.com. Note in the subject header, podcast question, and we will pick a listener's question and try to answer it as best as we can next week.
Sounds good.
All right. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Pamela.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. What do we have new on the list?
There's not a lot this week, actually. On the hardcover fiction list, there are four new titles, starting down at number 10. Ace Atkins, who picked up Robert B. Parker's Spencer series after Parker's death, has the next book in that series. It's called Robert B. Parker's Kickback. Then at number 9, Clive Barker continues his Barker's Books of Blood series with The Scarlet Gospels. At number 6, Mary Kay Andrews has a kind of a summer romance, a book called Beach Town. And at number 3, Neal Stephenson, the renowned science fiction writer, has a new novel out called Seven Eves. All one word, Seven Eves, new at number 3.
And what's number 1 on the bestseller list fiction side?
Still Paula Hawkins, The Girl on the Train. That has spent, I think, 13 consecutive weeks at number 1. I think you have to go all the way back to Dan Brown to find another book that's been on that long.
I know the publisher, Riverhead, has been saying that this might be the fastest selling book ever.
I know it has sold over 2 million copies in just 3 or 4 months.
Wow. Okay. On the top of the nonfiction list, someone who's a little bit more accustomed to being number one.
Yeah. David McCullough remains at number one this week with the Wright brothers, his biography. It's been on the list for 3 weeks and it remains at number one for at least the second week in a row. It was at number one last week. I can't remember if it entered the list right at number one, or if it climbed there. But this is its third week on the list, and it is at number one.
And there's only one new book on the nonfiction side.
It is a biography by Ashley Vance called Elon Musk, a biography of Elon Musk, the technology entrepreneur. He's co-founded PayPal and is famous now. He went on to head up SpaceX and Tesla Motors. Often looked at as kind of this generation's Steve Jobs.
We'll see if this book does as well as the biography of Steve Jobs did. Thanks so much, Greg.
Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For The New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.